In 1851, the American reformer Horace Bushnell declared that the nation's greatness did not result from the deeds of famous men, but from the heroic work of women at their spinning wheels. To understand the country, one must look at cloth as well as constitutions. My guest, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, a MacArthur Fellow and Professor of History at Harvard University, has done exactly that. Her book, The Age of Homespun, explores the making and meaning of stockings, rugs, tablecloths, and baskets. Her previous book, A Midwife's Tale, received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Ulrich, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're speaking to someone who is not, I believe this is the right word, a textilian. Perhaps you could help us understand exactly what homespun is.
Well, homespun literally is just rough, unfinished cloth. That is, it hasn't been through the fulling mill or it hasn't been dyed or refined in some way. Over time, however, particularly in the United States, it just came to mean homemade rather than, you know, the fancy commercial fabrics that were hand-woven in Europe or the British Isles.
Your book is a study of these kinds of products. I mentioned some of them at the start. Generally speaking, how accomplished was the work of the people who made homespun products?
Well, it varied tremendously. The New England area that I focused on, women were the weavers, and they were informally trained and very part-time. So they didn't make fancy, complex, geometric coverlets like you might find in the Middle Atlantic, where immigrant Scottish or German male weavers produced fabrics. But they came up with some rather fabulous things. New England bed rugs, for example, are a real American innovation, and they often began with a very plain woven, tabby woven, rather rough ground, and then were embroidered, literally covered completely, often with very simple stitches in homespun yarn, but in interesting designs that are really beautiful even today.
I should mention that your book is filled with pictures of the things that you talk about. One of the things that you do examine is a pocketbook made by an 18th century Indian woman, which you say tells a story of intercultural exchange. What is that story?
Well, it's a wonderful, complex story about a woman christened Maria Agate, or known in folklore as Molly Ockett. She was born in central Maine and spent part of her childhood as a refugee in Massachusetts during the French and Indian Wars of the mid-18th century. And then when she returned to Maine, she moved back and forth across borders. She was affiliated with a church, the Catholic parish in Montreal. She became friends with English settlers as they came into central Maine. And her pocketbook is a really wonderful example of the kind of melding of cultures. Pocketbook is a European form. We would think of it as a wallet. I mean, it was to hold money or similar kinds of things. The fabric, however, it goes back to very ancient textile traditions, was made probably from native hemp that had been completely twined in a beautiful geometric pattern using dyed moose hair.
The Industrial Revolution of the 18th century includes things like Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin and advances in power production. That's usually thought to have swept household domestic production aside. Is that what happened?
Well, that's what I thought happened when I began my project. I thought, great, this will end about 1790 or at least by 1800. But to my surprise, I discovered that household production actually expanded with early industrialization. And this was because factory spun cotton warp could be mixed with homegrown flax and kind of speed up and make possible quicker production of home weaving. And the early industrialization also meant the establishment of carding mills, which greatly increased the ease of producing woolen fabrics. Carding, the kind of combing to clean and align the fibers of the wool, was very, very time-consuming. And when machines took that over, then people increased their sheep raising, and they were able to do more spinning and weaving more easily.
It seems to make possible at least a speeding up of certain kinds of production, but the work remains. There is so much knitting going on in your book and embroidering. The work never seems to end. While you make that point, and I suppose it's obvious enough, you have another, for me, more interesting point, and that is that work itself had multiple meanings. The fact that women did so-called domestic work didn't mean that they only worked at home.
Oh, no. That's what is so wonderful about the history of textile production. In Europe, as in America, I mean, you think of all the symbolic meanings of the spinning wheel and the sense of weaving a web, whatever that might be. And in the United States, it certainly had political implications. During the American Revolution, one of the ways of establishing independence from Great Britain is to boycott British manufacturers in the pre-revolutionary period. And that meant creating both the literal and the symbolic value of women's work. And then in the early Republic again, the whole emphasis that somehow the work of women in the home is going to secure a kind of economic independence and a real sort of pastoral economy that would preserve us from some of the negative things associated with industrialization in Europe. Spinning and weaving were also central in what I call the female economy of these early societies. There was a lot of bartering and trading among women from household to household, and women really began to take responsibility for producing a lot of the fabrics that they took into marriage. And so the work literally bound people together, generations, neighborhoods, men's work and women's work as well.
Most of the articles that you examine in your book are successes of one kind or another. At the very least, the job is finished most of the time. So it's interesting, you devote a chapter to an unfinished sock. What could we read into that? Even the person who started it calls it a lack of perseverance.
Oh, right. Well, it's sort of a little metaphor, really, at the end of the book. In part, I suppose, I'm saying this story isn't finished, that we tend to want to do a linear narrative and there are endpoints, but industrialization didn't end domestic labor or domestic work. So you have mill girls knitting at begging for some homespun yarn from home in order to knit their woolen stockings at the time that they're working in mills and factories for the first time. Beyond that, the unfinished stocking, I think, exemplifies to me the curious way in which New Englanders preserved homely artifacts. And, you know, how did this thing survive? I mean, it's a pretty homely stocking. It's still on the needles. Did it just get left behind by mistake? And then at some point, it sort of became an icon of hard work and household industry and a kind of memorial to somebody who was no longer there. So the very fact that we can study early American textiles is predicated on the notion that they assumed symbolic power and that it was the labor that went into them, not just the finished product. And what you see, of course, in an unfinished object is the labor. You can see it almost in action, a sort of arrested motion.
We're talking here primarily about women and some men also in colonial America and the early Republic. I'm wondering what their idea about work was. It seems that at least two ideas come through in your book. Some see it as an absolute necessity. They measure their life by the work they do. And at the same time, especially for some of the women you talk about, work seems to be an imprisoning thing.
Uh-huh.
Was it liberating or imprisoning?
Well, both. It's easily romanticized. I think there were, particularly for young women who begin to read and read novels, begin to have some aspiration for an education, begin to take themselves seriously, there is a desire to surmount all this seeming constant drudgery and be able to achieve something permanent or lasting in the world. So there's that kind of tension. There's also, I think, a tension between what you're forced to make for yourself and what you might be able to buy at the store. This is a period of expanding consumption throughout the Atlantic world. And one of the things that was fascinating to me as I looked at store accounts and diaries was to see people working extraordinarily hard to make utilitarian fabrics for their households so that they could save what little bit of cash they might have or credit at the store in order to buy a fabric for a calico apron or a bit of lace or sometimes something even more extravagant than that, maybe some copper plate fabric to make a bed curtain. So there isn't a clear distinction between production and consumption in these households. The same people who are making cloth are also purchasing cloth, and these two strands are integrated in the household economy.
Well, there's another interesting conflict or tension here, too. It seems that many of the people want to believe that simplicity, unadorned goods are good, but there's a temptation for ornamentation and refinement. Uh-huh. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that mental, maybe it's a moral, tug of war.
Oh, yes. And it, too, develops out of the rhetoric of the revolution that liberty is better than luxury, that, you know, noble people are going to give up these goods coming in by ship in order to secure their freedom from British taxation, British tyranny, as they saw it. And so the notion that you might, you know, really want to have these things, teacups, for example, or some kind of fancy fabric or an imported broadcloth, I mean, that becomes politically explosive, and then it begins to carry a kind of moral value as well. And I also think there's a bit of a tension in among generations, young people, you know, wanting things that are new and exciting. And one of the things that fascinated me was to find fairly simple hand-woven linen fabrics embellished with meticulous kind of edgings to make them look more refined so that you could have a nice white tablecloth under your teacups, even if, you know, you're sort of in the mid of the muck and smells of a rural household.
This is the reality that we've been talking about so far, and yet the title of your book comes from a secular sermon of 1851 uh-huh. that I began with. And from those mid-19th century ideas, you suggest that a myth about homespun emerged, and you call it one of the central myths in American history. Could you elaborate on that? What is that myth of homespun, and what has its significance been?
Well, the myth is there, and it persists even to the present, that somehow people were more virtuous in times past because they were self-sufficient. They had to make everything themselves. They had to rely on themselves, and they had this kind of simple pastoral rural life. And those are very old ideas. I mean, you find those ideas in the Bible. You find them in Greek poetry. You find them in the Elizabethan era. But they took on political meanings in the United States through the American Revolution. I mean, we want to believe that our founding is essentially the virtuous, self-sufficient, hardworking, you know, embattled farmer of revolutionary fame. And it is a little surprising when you begin to look at the actual history to see that supposed self-sufficiency was driven by an expanding Atlantic economy, that from day one, people in New England are spinning cotton brought from the slave economy of the West Indies, that the expansion of household production involves the elimination of American Indians and the marginalization of American Indian textiles. I mean, the more you look at this mythology, you see that by focusing on the household and the benign woman sitting at her spinning wheel, you are able to ignore some of the other more troublesome narratives in early American history.
There's a point that you make in your book. Actually, it's first made by Horace Bushnell, the 1851 reformer. He suggests, and it seems to me that you second him in this, that history may be best understood in terms of process rather than events, which would be maybe good news for all of those history students who've had dates inflicted on them all the time. In what way is process as important, if not more important, than events?
Well, I think we could use certainly the example that we talked about a minute ago. If you go into a textbook, people memorize Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin, for example, and see that as a cause and effect. The invention of a particular artifact leads to an immense transformation in the economy. If you focus not on an event and a date, but you begin to look at a long-term developmental trajectory, you can see that the Industrial Revolution was an evolution in many ways, more than a revolution, and that it was a series of steps, certainly beginning with what some scholars have called the Industrious Revolution, that is, with the expansion of consumer goods stimulating ordinary people to work very hard to produce things in their own communities. And New England's Age of Homespun was part of that Industrious Revolution, which has been largely invisible because of our tendency to focus on, you know, dramatic moments and events.
Well, Professor Ulrich, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, the author of The Age of Homespun, Objects and Stories in the Creation of an American Myth.